Hello and welcome to this special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony on KLCC and KLCC.org. I'm Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony Association. As our world continues to grapple with the COVID-19 health crisis, we are all finding our own ways to stay connected to each other and preserve our sense of community. I might be a little biased, but I think that sharing music together does that like nothing else. So today we'll hear portions of a concert the orchestra performed in January 2020, along with some thoughts from three people who were integrally involved in it. We start with a short and mesmerizing work by composer Missy Mazzoli, who was born just outside Philadelphia and studied music at Yale University, the Royal Conservatory of The Hague in the Netherlands, and Boston University. These days, Mazzoli is one of America's most active composers, with a booming career that has brought her a Grammy nomination, a post as the Chicago Symphony's Composer in Residence, and a commission from the Metropolitan Opera in New York. In 2013, she wrote a work for the Los Angeles Philharmonic called Symphonia for Orbiting Spheres that combines traditional orchestra instruments, strings, winds, brass, and percussion, with some unusual ones, including a boombox that plays pre-recorded sounds and 10 harmonicas. In a recent phone call, I asked Missy Mazzoli where the inspiration for the piece came from and how it unfolds.
So there are a couple different elements to this piece. You know, the word symphonia has a lot of different meanings in musical history. It's a Baroque term for a work for orchestra, but it's also the word, an old Italian word for the hurdy-gurdy, which if you know this instrument, I'm in love with this instrument, and it's... You know, it's a sort of cranked medieval instrument where you crank a handle and then like it causes a wheel to vibrate against strings, which creates sound. And the sound of this instrument is really strange, always a little bit out of tune, and I really love that quality. So I tried to create that sort of quality within an orchestra. And then the orbiting spheres part, I just was thinking as I was writing it, what is the form of this piece going to be? And I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to have a piece in the form of a solar system? So the idea being that there are lots of little loops of music, these little orbits, that are all operating within a larger orbit. So I don't know if that sounds crazy, but this is what was going through my head. So I think that in the beginning, you hear these little tiny looped fragments of material. So there's these little melodies that kind of repeat and come back, come and go. And then the whole piece is also one big loop. So we end up, at the end of the piece, we end up where we started in the same way that a planet will go around the sun and a year later be back where it started, more or less. But the world is different. You know, everyone on that planet has aged a year and so much has happened. So, you know, that was the kind of idea for the form of the piece, too, that, you know, we end up where we started, but it's very transformed.
So I got to ask about those harmonicas. Where did you get that idea? I mean, it's so awesome. It's so effective. But how did you ever think of that?
Well, I actually used harmonicas in a bunch of different pieces. I first used them in a 2009 piece for this group called Eighth Blackbird. And I first wanted the pianist to play accordion, and then I thought, this piece will never be done again if I do that. I need some instrument that's a little more portable. So I had the idea of just having them play harmonicas and just not even having to have any skill with harmonica, just the sound of breathing in and out. And I love this sound. I think there's something really beautiful and vulnerable about the sound of the harmonica. So there was this kind of amazing thing of combining this very sort of elementary sound with all this virtuosity that comes out of an orchestra. And I love when those kinds of things like rub up against each other. So this was the first time that I'd used the harmonicas in an orchestral setting. But I then went on to use them in my last opera called Proving Up, where some of the singers and some of the players also play harmonicas.
It's super effective. And I have to say, it's just not unlike anything else I've ever heard. What, Missy, what do you hope people will take away from hearing this piece?
I just hope people like it. I hope that people say what you just said, which is that this is unlike anything I've ever heard. I mean, that's my goal with every piece, you know, is to create a brand new sound world, you know, that maybe has some familiar elements, again, like the sound, the wheezing sound of a harmonica or, you know, the sound of a string melody. I mean, there are these familiar elements that draw you in, but then I want people to be surrounded by a new world, by a new fabric, a new texture. So I hope people enjoy it and that they feel that it's something truly new, because that was my goal.
That's composer Missy Mazzoli talking about her piece called Sinfonia for Orbiting Spheres. Now let's hear it in its entirety in this performance by the Eugene Symphony. Music director and conductor Francesco Lecce-Chong led the orchestra in concert on Thursday, January 23rd, 2020 at the Holt Center for the Performing Arts. Music of Missy Mazzoli. Thank you. That was Sinfonia for Orbiting Spheres by American composer Missy Mazzoli, performed by the Eugene Symphony in a concert led by Francesco Lecce Chong on January 23, 2020. The piece was inspired both by a medieval instrument akin to a hurdy-gurdy and by the orbits of planets in a solar system. Next up, we'll hear the first movement of Jan Sibelius' Violin Concerto. It's hard to think of a composer who is more closely identified with their home country than is Jan Sibelius with Finland. Some listeners hear echoes of the Finnish language in the repeated rhythms of his music, and the spareness of his harmonic structure might conjure images of vast Nordic landscapes. His tone poem Finlandia, written in 1899, has become the de facto national anthem and made him a hero among Finns for generations. After Finlandia, Sibelius is best known in the concert hall for his seven symphonies and dramatic storytelling epics like Lemminkainen and the Kalevala, but he only wrote one concerto for solo instrument and orchestra, in this case for violin. To play it, we have soloist Elina Vahala, who was born in Iowa to Finnish parents and then spent her youth studying violin in Finland's famous music academies. I spoke with Elina by phone recently and asked her to tell us about the first movement of Sibelius' concerto that we'll hear, especially the very beginning that instantly sets the tone for what is to come.
Well, the opening, for sure, it takes you to some magical place. And it's so transparent, and at the same time, you are absorbed because your ears are kind of locked to the solo violin, which is immediately starts to kind of develop this beautiful main theme. Well, I think it's really, this concerto is one of those pieces where each moment of the music is leading to the next in a way that you feel like it cannot go any other way. Mm-hmm. And just I would recommend to really just like let the flow take you there. And one of the interesting things about the construction of the piece is that the development of the first movement is actually taking place in the solo cadenza, which is also very unusual. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the greatest cadenzas I've ever heard. It is so dramatic, and yeah, it's really developing the themes and launching you back then to the recap, and also very, very virtuosic and fast and flamboyant coda is something to look forward to at the end of the first movement. Mm. Very virtuosic. This is very hard stuff to play.
Yeah, quite. I liked what you said about how each moment leads to the next moment as if there was no other way it could be. I like what you said. And to me, this piece really sort of moves toward that cadenza. It's always building towards that as the kind of the apex of the sort of the conglomeration of all the ideas. Unlike a lot of sort of standard concertos where the cadenza is just kind of an afterthought toward the end of a movement as a final opportunity to show off a little bit and be virtuosic. To me, the cadenza really is the heart of this first movement. And it sounds both very technically difficult to play, but also interpretatively difficult to play. What's that cadenza about for you?
Technically, yes, it is quite challenging. But never in this concerto, the technique and the virtuosity, it's not a show-off. It's an integral part of the piece and the music. It's just the serving music. So that is what makes it wonderful to play.
So let me ask this, Galina. What does this piece mean to you as a Finnish violinist playing Sibelius's only concerto? What does this piece mean?
Well, first of all, I'm really grateful that there is such a piece that I can take everywhere, and I feel connected to it. It is a very dear concerto to me, and also I have grown up with it. I didn't perform it for quite a while. I mean, relatively late. I think I was 25 when I played for the first time, but of course I still grew up with it.
through all those Sibelius competitions that you would listen to, you know, when you were a kid, and also in concerts. So somehow it is a special concerto. I'm very, very glad that one of the absolute best violin concertos of the repertoire is actually from my home country. So I think I get some advantage of it.
Violinist Alina Vahala talking about Jan Sibelius's Violin Concerto in D minor, opus 47. Now let's hear the first and most substantial of its three movements, marked Allegro Moderato. Here's violinist Alina Vahala, along with Francesco Lecce Chong, leading the Eugene Symphony in this performance on January 23rd, 2020. The music of Jan Sibelius.
Thank you.
The first movement of Jan Sibelius' Violin Concerto in D minor, Opus 47. Finnish violinist Elina Vahala was our soloist, accompanied by the Eugene Symphony under the baton of Francesco Lecce-Chang. Next up, we'll hear the final two movements of Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 2 in D major. You're listening to a special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony on KLCC-FM and KLCC.org. I'm Scott Freck. Johannes Brahms was born in Hamburg, Germany in 1833, just 6 years after Ludwig van Beethoven had died. Brahms quickly rose to prominence first as a pianist, performing public recitals by the age of 12, and then later as a composer while still in his teens. At 20, he was taken under the wings of composers Robert and Clara Schumann, and as his career started to take off, whispers that he was the rightful heir to Beethoven started to be heard across Europe. And while his success and fame grew in his 30s, he never could quite finish his first symphony, writing in a letter to a friend, "You can't have any idea what it's like to always hear such a giant marching behind you." He eventually did complete one, at the age of 43, and after working on it off and on for many years. His second such symphony, though, came to him much more easily, pouring out in just a few months in the summer of 1877. In a recent phone call, I asked Eugene Symphony's music director and conductor, Francesco Lecce-Chang, what sets Brahms' second symphony apart from the first.
It's one of really the most fascinating stories when we think about a composer like Brahms, who, you know, relatively speaking, we don't have a lot of the music that he wrote because he was such a perfectionist that he just ended up burning all of his sketches. And so, unlike someone like Beethoven, we don't really know what Brahms' process was, and he probably burned some things that we would consider to be masterpieces now. But what we do have from him, each piece is so monumental in its own way. And the first symphony in particular was something that he kind of turned around in his head over the course of 40 years, which is just insane to think about a composer like him. But at the same time, you know, if you had to start composing in the decade after Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you'd probably have the same problems too. You know, literally the greatest work of all time has been written, and now you have to try to compose in its shadow. And that really dug at Brahms when he was working on the first symphony, and that's why he just kept on putting it away. I mean, he wrote a whole piano concerto in that time that sounds like a symphony, it feels like a symphony, but Brahms just, when it came to the word symphony, really struggled to get that first symphony across. And I love the first symphony for that. Like, I think it's one of perhaps Brahms' least perfect works, but that's also what makes it wonderful, is you can hear Brahms struggling to break free, to find his voice. And I think it's exhilarating when you get to that final movement and you have that melody that just has that hint of Ode to Joy in it, that finally comes in the strings. But also this incredible release where you see that Brahms has finally figured it out and it finally comes together. What's crazy then is, what is it, like 3 months or 4 months later, like the next summer after he finishes the first symphony, which took him 40 years, in a matter of months, he finishes his second symphony.
Right.
And you can hear the musical release in it, like the quiet confidence that we love from Brahms. That's what we get in the second symphony. Right from the get-go, you know, this just very simple motif in the bass line, and then you have the beautiful horn melody answered by the woodwinds, you know, perfectly in balance. Everything has that kind of classical balance to it and that form that we expect from Brahms. But I think overall, when I think about the second symphony, what really makes it so special is that on a technical level, it's mind-blowing, but on an emotional level, it's one of the most exhilarating journeys we can take.
So, Francesco, we're going to hear the third and the fourth movements from this second symphony. What can we expect?
The third movement really opens up with this just gorgeous oboe solo over these very simple pizzicati in the cellos. And what I love about this melody is the way it has these little stops and starts, these little pauses. And it meanders along so beautifully, and then is contrasted by these two kind of scherzando sections, like much quicker and much lighter, and the strings and the winds pass back and forth, these very quick little motifs. And then that leads us into the finale, which, you know, wonderfully, Brahms doesn't want to give anything away, and it starts off so soft. It's actually one of the hardest things for an orchestra to do. I I get nervous just thinking about having to rehearse the opening of this fourth movement, because it's like whispering in the strings. It's very excited whispering, and the melody itself is kind of all over the map. It has kind of big, you know, it goes quite high and then drops down, but each of the string sections are kind of playing their own meandering melody, and they all come together. And so when you're playing that soft, that's one of the most difficult things, is to play very quickly and very softly, and nothing's articulated. So everything is very smooth at the same time. So it's just very, what we say in music is sotto voce, which is, you know, under the voice, this kind of whispered quality. And then suddenly, in a way, it's very kind of unlike Brahms to shock us like this. You know, the orchestra then thunders in after it comes to this kind of odd pause. The orchestra thunders in, and suddenly, you know, we're off to the races in this, you know, I think perhaps one of the most exuberant movements that Brahms ever wrote. Certainly for orchestra, it is just this outpouring of joy.
That's Eugene Symphony's music director Francesco Lecce-Chong talking about Johannes Brahms's Symphony No. 2 in D major. Now here's Francesco leading the Eugene Symphony in two movements from it. First up is movement 3, marked Allegretto Grazioso, quasi-andantino, followed by the finale, marked Allegro con spirito. Music of Johannes Brahms. the final two movements of Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 2 in D major, in a performance by the Eugene Symphony, led by music director and conductor Francesco Lecce-Chong on January 23, 2020, at the Holt Center for the Performing Arts in Eugene, Oregon. Earlier in the program, we heard the first movement of Jan Sibelius' violin concerto with violin soloist Elena Vahala, and Missy Mazzoli's Sinfonia for Orbiting Spheres. This broadcast was sponsored in part by Farmers Union Coffee Roasters. The Eugene Symphony would also like to thank Summit Funding, which sponsored the concert in January 2020, and Jonak Law Group, which was guest artist sponsor for violin soloist Elena Vahala. Special thanks to the musicians of the Eugene Symphony and Local 689 of the American Federation of Musicians. The concert was recorded by Bill Barnett of Gung Ho Studios. This has been a special broadcast of the Eugene Symphony in partnership with KLCC-FM, NPR for Oregonians, in downtown Eugene. I'm Scott Freck, Executive Director of the Eugene Symphony Association, and we hope to see you at the Holt Center or out in the community soon. Thanks for listening.